another elephant.
Part of the celebrated box sketch performed by Jimmy James & Co. If you've never seen the box sketch, then you've missed a treat. In creating it, Jimmy James may well have invented alternative comedy half a century before anyone else, which isn't to suggest that he was a cult figure. Far from it, he was a big star. The best comedians you can think of revered Jimmy James. Go on, think of a comic, as good as there's ever been. Come on, we've only got half an hour. Look, I'll help you out. Eric Morecambe? He rated him.
As a comedian, Jimmy James must have been one of the most creative, one of the funniest comics that this country has ever seen. He had that thing that broke all barriers with an audience. He was loved by the pros, the professionals, and loved by the audience. Now, Jimmy had this fantastic gift that he was liked and loved, and this is an important word, he's loved by both. One of the few comedians that all the comics used to stand on the side and watch. One of the greats.
The comedian's comedian was born in South Bank in Middlesbrough in 1893. He started performing at the age of 12 in local talent shows. There were lots of them in those days. Local variety contests where down-at-heel families would try and put tripe and chitterlings on the table with a few quid won in prize money by their charmless caterwauling offspring. Snot-nosed urchins trussed up in ill-fitting costumes and thrust onto clapboard stages. If you forced your kids into it these days, they'd be phoning Childline. But Jimmy James was desperate to get on the stage, desperate and destined to be a star. His son, former BBC Light Entertainment producer Jim Casey, remembers one such contest witnessed by fellow comic Dave Morris.
He said, now imagine this boy of about 12 and it's got to Friday and it's the final. And everybody thought a boy would win it who had a beautiful alto voice and he wore this lovely velvet suit. And he said, your father went to the man in charge on Friday before the show and said, I'm going to sing a different song. And he asked the man to introduce him as the boy who sold the newspapers round the corner. He came on with some newspapers in his bare feet and sang, ring down the curtain, I can't sing tonight. My little one's dying, my pride and delight, and so on. And Dave said there wasn't a dry eye in the house and the little lad in the velvet suit had had it before he came on. He said, now that is genius at 12.
Well, it serves the cocky little velvet-suited wussy right. So even at that age, Jimmy James could change his act at short notice, and his adaptability was to prove invaluable as he learnt his craft. He joined a kids' troupe called the Singing Jockeys. He formed a double act called the Two J's with fellow comic Jimmy Howells. He was also a singer in musicals, marrying a chorus girl along the way, a lightning cartoonist, and a whistling impressionist of bird calls. Strange to think of a time when people with only two halfpennies to rub together would shell out one of them to see a bloke making the sound of a coot. Jimmy James's first West End show was in 1944, when he starred in Jenny Jones at the London Hippodrome. Jim Casey.
It was a play with music, written by an American woman. Now, he wasn't allowed to alter a word. George Black was the great producer at the time, and he thought my father was an actor. And there was nothing funny in the play at all. So the critics panned it. The next day they had a meeting and George Black said, Jim, do anything you like. Try and keep it running. Well, it ran for about 9 months. And my father created some of his best comedy there.
He was driven by the thrill of creating something new. And he succeeded with the box sketch. Right, here goes. The box sketch features James and two stooges. One is a gangly, gormless gargoyle in a deerstalker going by the name of Eli Woods. In real life, James's nephew Jack. The other is a dodgy character in a long coat. This stooge was played by a variety of individuals, some with unlikely names, as Jim Casey remembers.
The first one who came on saying, are you putting it around an iron bar, me, with a long coat, was my Uncle Andy, my father's brother. Then there was Eli's father. He was on for a little bit, Uncle John. My mother's brother was another stooge called Hutton Conyers, yeah, who was quite famous with him for many years. His real name was Jack Darby, but Father used to give everybody names, and we were driving along in Yorkshire one day, and he saw this village, Hunt and Conyers. He said, "That's a great stage name. You're Hunt and Conyers from now on." And Andy, he called him Bretton Woods after the conference.
The box sketch begins with Jimmy, fag in hand, Trilby at rakish angle, ambling towards the centre of the stage, accompanied by the stammering beanpole Eli Woods. From the opposite side, Long Coat enters with a shoebox under his arm. And so begins one of the most celebrated sequences in the history of comedy. Look, I know I'm making a big deal of this, but don't take my word for it. Take Les Dawson's.
I was always grateful, in a way, that I actually met Jimmy James, who, of course, is a legend. Because Jimmy James, to me, again, utilised words, as well as being extremely funny. To me, that was a tremendous act. I mean, one of the lines he came out with, again, was, you know, to illustrate this use of a word, was the fact when the stooge walks on with a long coat and the box, and Jimmy turns to me and says, "What have you got in the box?" And the stooge says, "A lion." Now, it's the way Jimmy paced the line. And he looked away and he looked back again. He said, "I thought I heard a rustling." And it's a gorgeous word, because rustle is the word. Yeah. Well, what is it? But it's the word rustle.
Popular in South Africa as well.
They're very nice people.
Yes, and just before I came home, they gave me a lovely present.
Did they?
Yes.
What did they give you?
Two man-eating lions.
Real lions?
Yes.
Did you fetch them home?
Mm.
Where do you keep them?
In this box.
Go and get two copies, one with strychnine in.
You're telling him about the lions.
Oh, he's got two lions in that box. Are they in there now?
Yes.
I thought I heard a rustling. He's got two lions in that box.
How much are they?
He doesn't want to sell them.
He dealt with ordinary things, ordinary people, but he just had this way of highlighting things that people wouldn't think of for themselves. And then he had this great thing of working with other people.
But if the ensemble manipulation was meticulous, James's true genius lay in the ability to make surrealism utterly accessible. Comedy producer John Fisher.
It's not so much to do with the words, which had an originality all of their own. Nobody else could ever have thought of those. It's to do with the pauses. It's to do with acting. It's to do with... In fact, if you want to know where Jimmy James had his greatest influence, I think it was on Tony Hancock, who was probably the greatest comic actor the music hall, the comedy tradition has produced in sort of my lifetime. Not only was he the comedian's comedian, but perhaps he was the greatest comedian's comedian.
Excuse me, mister, excuse me. Yes, what do you want?
Well, I have a note for you. It's about our Eli.
Your Eli?
Yes.
Who's your Eli?
I'm our Eli.
What's the note about?
Well, last Monday, our Eli bit a fella's ear off. So the magistrate said he'd have to see a cyclist and get examined.
Cyclist?
Yes.
Examined?
Yes.
I should think you mean a psychiatrist.
Ah, that's it.
Have him analysed and see what he's made of.
Yes. Yeah, the man wants to know what you're made of.
Sugar and spice and all things nice. That's what little girls are made of.
See, we've never told him any different, mister.
Jimmy James is the only comic in this series to have relied so heavily on stooges, and in particular Eli Woods. This stuttering, skinny six-footer with the vacant expression was the butt of the routine's ever-changing opening exchanges. A classic moment has James informing the audience that Eli is going to break the world record for free-fall parachuting by being taken up to 25,000 feet, jumping, and not opening his chute until he's 10 feet from the ground. A bemused Eli raises a pertinent point of safety procedure by asking what happens if his parachute doesn't open. Big laughs. James looks at him with a mixture of pity and disdain and says, "You can jump 10 feet, can't you?" It was this kind of interplay which underpinned James's comedy. Yet despite his reliance on others, there was no doubting who was boss. Jim Casey.
If he gave you a line, you had to reply. And what you said had to be either funny or giving him a chance to be funny. And if you didn't, when you came off, he'd say, what the hell's the matter with you? You were standing there. Are you cue struck? Why didn't you come in? When we were working at Blackpool, we used to do a song, Hey Round the Corner, it was called. And my father used to say to me, to lead into it, we've had a lot of requests for songs. What do you suggest we sing out the two songs we know? And I used to say, Hey Round the Corner. And before we went on, Eli said to me, when he asks you, don't answer him because I've got one. So when he said to me, what do you suggest we sing? I didn't reply. And behind his back, he says, what was a new song that had just come out, Who's Got Me Ding Dong? And my father said, pardon? He said, Who's Got Me Ding Dong? He said, I don't know that. How do I? Did you have it with you when you came on? You're a big lad, you ought to be able to look after it. And he went on and got about five laughs about this Who's Got Me Ding Dong.
Who's got me ding dong? How the hell do I know who's got me ding dong? You're a big lad now, you can look after it, can't you? Stupid.
Don't look at me, I haven't got his ding dong.
Who said you had?
You were looking at me.
You can be looked at, can't you?
I have been looked at.
I haven't been seen to.
And the next night, we kept it in, of course. The next night, the only time in my life I made him laugh on the stage. Because as he went through all this routine again, about the ding-dong, what colour is it, and reported to the police, but as he turned back, he repeated it. He said such nonsense, who's got me ding-dong? And I leant over and said, have you lost yours as well? And the place erupted, and he started to laugh. And he walked back and he walked forward and then he finished me because he said, he's funny, you're sacked. 2 weeks' notice, 500 quid, and you're finished. And I was gone.
Jimmy James undoubtedly had a great comic brain, but his ability to deliver the routines to an audience depended not just on great timing, but on a physical presence, particularly in the face. It was his face that sold the gags, because otherwise he was anything other than imposing.
He was about 5'7", stocky, jet black hair, a wonderful creased comic's face. I mean, his early days, he was a very handsome man. I've got photographs of him when his early days were a juvenile lead. He used to be the singer and the romantic lead in the shows, and very, very good looking. But later on, he had this wonderful creased face, that's what you can say, it's lived-in face. And it lent itself to wonderful comic expressions and reactions.
And like so many comedians before and since, notably Ken Dodd and his tickling stick, he used a prop to accentuate and punctuate the material. John Fisher.
Perhaps most familiar example in recent years has been George Burns with his cigar and the way he'd used the cigar to draw out a pause. Well, Jimmy James was doing all that with his cigarette. It's quite remarkable that the simple gesture of taking a cigarette from his mouth and back again, and the expression and the meaning he could convey with that gesture. That cigarette had a life of its own. His lips seemed to have a life of their own, divorced from his body. They were on a strange collision course of their own.
The most recent example of the James business with the cigarette was seen regularly in Coronation Street. Night after night, Les Dawson's old accomplice Roy Barraclough embellished his characterisation of Alec Gilroy with distinctly Jamesian mannerisms behind the bar of The Rover's Return. Bette Lynch handled her famous fag holder in much the same way. At any time, in any pub, you'll see someone reinforcing their point with a thrust of the smouldering king-size. Not that pubs were Jimmy James's natural habitat. Many comics seem to find it almost impossible to get up on stage without being drunk. Not Jimmy James. Fellow performer Tommy Trinder.
He was a great artist on the stage. He had a wonderful sense of humour. There was one thing we had in common. We were both teetotalers. And this was a great gag because whenever we got on the bill together, Jim would say, hello, Tom, hello, Jim. Let's get a quarter of a pound of wine gums and get stinking.
But it hadn't always been that way. In the early days, he could drink with the best of them. He'd have held his own on a night out with Frank Randall. But it had to stop. An ultimatum was delivered, although ultimately by himself. Jim Casey.
He did actually have a row with my mother, and my mother went home to Hartlepool. And my father turned up on Sunday and said, I won't drink any more. And she said, well, that's silly, but you'll have to cut it down. He said, I won't drink again. And he never did, and that was it.
Of course, drunks have a particular way of speaking to each other. They can converse through a series of nods, slurs and belches that are utterly impenetrable to the stone-cold sober. In a similar way, parents may have marvelled at the ability of adolescent boys to communicate almost entirely in grunts. They're special codes devised to convey meaning only to those in the know. Jimmy and his family had a code. Roy Castle was one of the few who broke into this inner sanctum and was allowed to be one of the stooges. He learned their language.
They used to say one thing and mean another. And what they were doing is that they were sending messages about people in the room. You see, if there was somebody came into the room who was really boring, because Jimmy had his brother there, his brother Peter, and if there was somebody in the room who was really boring and perhaps, you know, wanting to borrow something, Jimmy always used to say to Peter, I'm just going to check the hamper, Peter. And that meant, get them out. And then the other one was, if you ever said to somebody in the dressing room, oh, look at this chap, he's tall enough to be a policeman, you know. That meant, he's a complete twit.
There's something so endearing about comedians who create scenarios like that. Real-life sketches the public never sees. It's as if they've got comedy to spare, and it spills off the stage and into everyday existence. But despite Jimmy's secret code and mischief-making, it would be wrong to suggest that he was an uncharitable performer. John Fisher.
When Val Parnell, who was the impresario responsible for booking the Palladium, decided in the late 1940s that the key to revive variety in the West End was to bring in all the big American attractions, it was Jimmy James who was booked as the second top on the first bill. He was second top to a man called Mickey Rooney, and there's a wonderful story that Mickey Rooney, who of course was a major Hollywood name at the time, but he didn't really have an act. And he went on the first night and died to death. And it was Jimmy James who took him aside and spent the next day with Mickey Rooney, working out how he could get by, telling him what to do here, what order to put the sequence.
Americans, eh? Over here, overpaid, and with no act. The audacity of it. You'd have thought that playing second fiddle to a blatantly unfunny Mickey Rooney would have made a man like James resentful, but it didn't. Fellow performers he had plenty of time for, but like Frank Randall, it was a different story with the gaffers. Eli Woods.
What he couldn't stand was the hierarchy of show business. He had more arguments with the hierarchy, and probably that was one of the reasons why he was never as big a name as he ought to have been. Val Parnell, for instance, who was the head of Moss Empires, I pulled Jimmy James off Val Parnell because Val Parnell knocked on... Well, he didn't knock on the door, he just burst open his dressing room and started shouting about something. Jimmy James got hold of him and had him up against the wall, and Val Parnell said, you'll never work another Moss Empires day, you know.
But like many people in the public eye, he was driven by enormous self-belief and the safe assertion that he was always right.
Many years ago, he had his agent and him had a bit of a go at each other, and something had happened, and he said to me to send a telegram to his agent, which was a bit of a naughty one. And so I wrote it out and read it back to him, and he said, get it off, send it off to him. So I went to the post office and I sent it off. Now, the next day, his agent was on the phone and he had a bit of a needle about this sort of telegram. And when I went to his hotel, he said to me, oh, I've just had Gerard Heath on the phone. That was his agent. And he said, I said so-and-so. I said, yes, you did. He said, I didn't. I said, Uncle, you did. He said, I'm telling you I didn't. So that afternoon, I went to the post office and I got a copy of the telegram. And when I went in to do the first house, I got a copy of the telegram. I said, oh, there's the telegram you said you didn't send. And he looked at it, and he read it, and he said, well, all I can say is somebody in the post office must have altered it. So, I don't know. God, you can't win.
Well, I can sympathise there. My wife says I'm like that. She says I never admit when I'm wrong. I say that's not true, and that I'm happy to admit that I'm wrong. I just haven't been wrong yet. And if you're right, you shouldn't admit you're wrong. Am I right? But the contrary personalities of comedians should surprise no one. And it comes as no shock to discover that Jimmy James offstage bore little resemblance to Jimmy James on.
Offstage, he was pretty serious. He said very witty things, but he was never jolly, jolly Joe. You know, he would never tell a joke or anything like that. Well, in fact, he was a terrible joke teller, because if we were ever in company and he started to tell a joke, I'd stop him and I'd say, I'll tell it, you'll ruin it. And the reason was, he would get about 10 laughs on the way to the end, and by the time he got the end, it wasn't funny.
So here was a bloke whose major faults were improvising gags en route to the punchline and never owning up to being wrong. Hardly damning stuff. He might have been a bit grumpy from time to time, but he didn't booze, didn't chase women, was kind to children, animals and Mickey Rooney. Surely he must have had one vice.
When I first left the army in the war and I came to work for my father, the main object was to stop him gambling. I hadn't thought about going on the stage at the time, and I failed. It was a losing battle. You could not win it. I mean, Eli was with him when I was in the army in the war, and he won £5,000 one afternoon while he was in a pantomime at Manchester. During the matinee, he won £5,000 on a bet. He rang his agent and said, don't book me any work for 3 months. And they went off racing, and he finished up about £30,000 ahead. Now, this is 1945, and I came on leave the end of 1945, and he'd bought a house for himself, a house for me. My house was £1,200, his was £3,000. He had no money. He had a £2,000 mortgage on his house and an £800 mortgage on mine. So that had all gone in about 8 weeks.
All right, so it was a lot of cash, but you've got to have a hobby. And if you're a big star like he was, there was always another payday on the horizon. To Jimmy James, it was Monopoly money.
There was 380-odd sort of theatres open, number ones, number twos and number threes, so you could work 52 weeks a year, yeah, in variety. So really, you know, he never had any value for money. Half the time, he never knew how much he had in his pocket.
And he didn't need to know how much he had in his pocket. All he needed to know was that he had enough, and he had more than enough. He wasn't just a big name in the theatres. As early as 1947, he'd broken into films, making Over the Garden Wall for Mancunian Films with the hugely influential comic Norman Evans. By 1960, he was on the telly in the sitcom Meet the Champ, where he co-starred with Bernard Breslau. Eventually, though, the paychecks became less frequent and less generous. But James couldn't cut back on the gambling. It was too late. He was addicted. Jim Casey.
I never went on holiday with them in my life, as a boy, as a child. I mean, I was away at school a lot, but I used to go to where he was working. But we never, ever went away on holiday. I mean, we didn't even go for a weekend, ever. Because he wanted to go racing. I mean, he was the most generous man and kind man and friendly and warm, but he had this thing, this racing thing, which governed his whole life.
And it soon started to govern other lives as well. His wife Emmy became addicted, though not to the gambling.
He and my mother got on extremely well, in spite of his gambling, and she then started drinking quite heavily, which was very weird because he was teetotal. But he kind of put up with her because she put up with his gambling.
She put up with him, he put up with her. Sounds reasonable. Putting up with each other. That's what marriage is all about, isn't it? But the stress of a lifestyle spent trawling provincial theatres to sustain his gambling habit began to tell on the ageing Jimmy James. And in 1964, during the summer season in Skegness, the inevitable happened. He had a heart attack. Eli Woods.
Coming out of Skegness, and on the outskirts of Skegness, there was a bill, and right across the top was Jimmy James. And I cried my eyes out because that's... I knew that was the last time I'd ever see his name on a bill, you know, and I really was very sad about it.
He never did appear again, and a comedy legend had left the stage for the last time. Jimmy James died in August 1965, a year after being taken ill in Skegness. Material with the timeless quality of the box sketch will never be forgotten. It was brave, it was new, it took audiences to places they hadn't been to before. Most of all, though, it will be remembered because it's still funny. And yet the memory of Jimmy James is not without sadness. Here was a comic genius who was lost not only to the self-centred nature of the performer, but also to the addiction of gambling. His son Jim Casey is rightly proud of his father's legacy, but even he remembers him as a comedian first and a dad second. And whichever way you look at it, there's something sad about that.
I think of him as Jimmy James, a comedian, really. Because Jimmy James, the father, we didn't spend much time together, really, all over the years. Except he loved me very, very much, and I loved him. But he was very absorbed in himself. First as a performer, secondly as a gambler. And his world was his world and not our world. He gave everything except himself.
Well, the magistrate said, our Eli's like an animal biting people's ears off. And when I come to think of it, he's been knocking about with our Oscar a lot lately.
Who's Oscar? His brother?
Don't know Oscar's a parrot, no relation.
The only way to cure him of biting people is to get someone to bite him.
Now, that's a good idea. Why not put him in that cage with a gorilla?
That'd cure him, wouldn't it? Yes, but what about the smell?
Oh, the gorilla will get used to that.
Mark Radcliffe wrote and presented How Tickled Am I, today tracing the career of the comedian's comedian, Jimmy James. The producer was Bernadette McConnell. Next week, Mark will present a profile of a true all-round performer who is equally at home in straight or comedy.